we're going to go live. Okay, tonight, class number 5 on our themes in Chumash, Yitzchak and Yaakov, maintaining the movement. So last week, we dealt with the character of Avram. Did everybody have a sheet?
Yep.
Okay, here's another sheet. We should have an extra sheet around.
Okay. There wasn't any homework
last week, was there? I did not... My business is your benefit. I didn't get to crank out the homework, so I know it's been that kind of time. Anyways, I know you're not complaining. All right.
Sounds like you're complaining.
I'm not complaining.
All right, let's move on. Okay, last week we talked about Avram. We compared it to who? To him. We contrasted Avram with
Galileo.
Very good. Excellent. Good recall. All right. Now we're talking about Avram's son, which is Yitzchak, and his grandson Yaakov, maintaining the movement. So we're going to go to the videotape. Here we go.
The channel transition. Of a man who literally changed the way we live our lives every day. Steve Jobs, the visionary founder and leader of Apple Computer, has died at the age of 56. A giant in business, technology, and entertainment, Steve Jobs had been battling pancreatic cancer for 8 years. His place in history was assured when he helped invent the personal computer, but that was only the beginning. Here is ABC's Bill Weir.
Before we put a virtual world at our fingertips,
and we call it the iPad.
Before we turn household tools into objects of desire,
today Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
Before you change the way we are entertained,
and you can watch it on your iPod.
A 20-year-old Steve Jobs launched a revolution from his parents' garage. With buddy Steve Wozniak, they set out to move the power of the computer from the laboratory to your lap.
The penalty for failure for trying to start a company in this valley is non-existent.
And this brimming confidence was validated when they launched the Macintosh.
We worked hard, and in 10 years, Apple had grown from just the two of us in a garage into a $2 billion company with over 4,000 employees.
But the 80s brought a power struggle with Apple's board, and Jobs was soon fired from the company he founded.
And so at 30, I was out, and very publicly out. What had been the focus of my entire adult life was gone, and it was devastating.
But he did not wallow, and in his 30s, he met his wife, started another computer company called Next, and took over Pixar, changing animation forever.
My name is Woody, and this is Andy's room.
In 96, Apple bought Next, and soon Jobs was back in charge, leading a digital renaissance. After his return, Apple stock soared more than 7,000%. Turning that garage startup into one of the most valuable companies in history. And in a valley of geniuses, his myth grew into Thomas Edison meets Willy Wonka proportions, building anticipation for invention shrouded in secrecy.
Are you using that currently as your phone?
I haven't been able to because I can't take it out in public.
While keeping his life fiercely under wraps, not even his board knew of his pancreatic cancer.
I just wanted to mention this.
And he didn't reveal he had a liver transplant until after the procedure.
I now have the liver of a mid-20s person who died in a car crash.
Through life, while his body grew frail, that mind, that drive, never quit. A standing ovation welcomed his surprise appearance at the spring launch of the iPad 2. But then came this letter in August. I've always said that if there ever came a day when I could no longer meet my duties, I would be the first to let you know, he wrote. Unfortunately, that day has come. Here was a man who peered into the future, seeing how we work and play 20 years before we'd ever hold the proof.
Everything will be portable. People want large color screens that they can put photographs on. People want motion video.
And when the body began to fail, he was driven anew by the clock and that burning need to build something great.
Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death. leaving only what is truly important.
A titan of American business, Steve Jobs was just 56 years old. He leaves behind a wife and four children. And just minutes ago, Apple's board of directors issued a statement saying, in part, Steve's brilliance, passion, and energy were the source of countless innovations that enrich and improve all of our lives. The world is immeasurably better because of Steve. We're going to have much more on the life and impact of this remarkable American, Steve Jobs, on a special edition of Nightline, and you can get the latest any...
Okay. All right, a couple of questions here. When Steve Jobs died, what challenges did Apple potentially face?
Success.
Trust in the company
without his leadership. Like, basically, he had already got the Lenore's... He had become such a figure of profound genius and excellence that without him, people think, well, the whole company's going to fall apart. So his successor, Tim Cook, took over. Was what did he have to do? What was his fundamental job?
Pick up the mantle.
He had to prove himself that he could gather all the resources of all their scientists and all their product design people, and the excellence of Apple will continue. And was that a simple job? Let's go to the next video tape, John.
Steve Jobs. The time of transition from Steve Jobs as leader of Apple to Tim Cook was an incredibly charged moment, very close to his own death. He said to Tim Cook, I don't ever want you to ask, what would Steve Jobs do? I want you to do what is right. None of the genius that is attributed to Steve Jobs would ever been able to happen had it not been for the supply chain that Tim Cook built. And when he started, there wasn't much of a supply chain. Apple actually made a lot of its own products. When Tim Cook dismantled that, he began to assemble an amazing sort of chain of suppliers. Apple would deeply integrate with these suppliers, going way upriver to fundamental technologies so that they would be the first in line to get them and they would be made to the standards that Apple wanted. The combination of all those things gave Apple an advantage that to this day, no other electronics company has, and it's very hard to imagine that anyone ever will.
The Apple Watch is the most advanced timepiece ever created.
To say, oh, Cook hasn't come out with an amazing, groundbreaking product like Steve Jobs has, well, the climate isn't quite ready for that to happen. Things like the iPhone, the iPad, the iPod were the product of the right moment when memory became affordable and processors became more energy efficient and display technology reached a certain point that you could start to actually make those products. I would argue that right now we're a little bit in between the next big moment. Remains the only openly homosexual CEO of a Fortune 500 company, which seems shocking, but it's true. His own privacy was becoming outweighed by the need to contribute to a raising of tolerance. He seems to now have moved into other areas as well. He has been very vocal on the aspects of privacy. He has made the company very environmentally responsible, and he famously said something along the lines of, we are trying to leave the world better for our children than it was for us, and if you're not interested in us doing that, you should get out of our stuff.
When you're out in the wild, you will see Macs everywhere now. They're in businesses, they're in coffee shops and airports, and hopefully they're in your living room.
Cook occupies a position in business that arguably no other person does. Apple has actually performed better financially under Tim Cook than it had under Steve Jobs. So he has a lot of wind behind his sails, if you will, to be able to be in the vanguard. And he wants to use it so that his legacy isn't just supply chains and product development, but also potentially a different way that companies can behave in the world and affect real change.
All right. So what did Tim Cook effectively do?
He created his own startup.
Number so he wasn't trying to be Steve Jobs number two. which is extremely, like, nearly impossible to do that, A. And he, well, first of all, he made the company more financially successful, which is pretty good. And now, the reason why I'm bringing up the issue of succession, obviously, if we talked about Avram, we're talking about Yitzchak and Yaakov, what's fundamentally the biggest challenge that the patriarchs, the Avot, had? After you're starting off with, starting out of the gate, we got Avram Avinu. Now what?
Still being successful. Be successful on your own.
Right, so who's under a tremendous pressure here?
Yitzchak.
Does he have, from what you remember from the story, does he have the same set of skills as Avram?
No.
He is not the charismatic figure as Avram is. So at this point, at the vulnerable beginnings, Judaism, in its nascent form, could have ended up what?
One hit wonder.
Over. One hit, one, and done. Okay? So that's what I want to focus on tonight. We're going to do for the next 34 minutes. Never set you out late. We're going to learn a little bit about the the transition from Avram to Yitzhak to Yaakov. We're going to have to go a little quickly because a lot of text. Okay, who would like to read our case again? And we'll go around the room. First box. Isaac and the Philistines. Everybody got it?
There's a famine in the land, aside from the first famine in the time of Abraham. Isaac went to Abimelech, king of the Philistines, to Gerar. God appeared to Isaac and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Remain undisturbed in the land that I shall designate to you. Remain an immigrant in this land. I will be with you and bless you. It will be to you and your offspring that I will give all of these lands. I will thus keep the oath that I made to your father Abraham. I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and grant them all of these lands. All the nations on earth shall be blessed through your descendants. All this is because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commitments, my decrees, and my laws."
Okay, so the question is, why does Hashem relate to Yitzchak, Isaac, in terms of Avram? He's not saying, "I'm going to do this because you're awesome. I'm going to help you out because Avram." Why?
He has to earn his own space.
So if that's the thing, so then let him be on it. If he has to earn it, then say, "Okay, you get no extra advantage." Why is he giving Yitzchak anything?
He's a son of
Ben. Okay, that's it. Boom. The one word answer is covenant, or the word Hebrew is brit. Avram made a brit, a covenant. What is a covenant? What's the definition of a term of a covenant?
Contract.
It's a contract, but it's not just. Well, what's the difference between a covenant and a contract? What? It's an oath, but it's a multi-generational or nearly eternal deal. So Hashem said he made a deal with Avram that your descendants are going to eventually have this land of Canaan. You'll be my special people. So Avram, basically, Hashem is relating. So is Yitzchak special, really? Right? Is Yitzchak really special in his own right from the introductory text?
No.
Not. We can't detect that. He said all he's telling him is, you know, there's a famine. Don't go to Egypt. Why would they go down to Egypt? Why would Yitzchak naturally want to go down to Egypt? What does Egypt have in times of famine?
Food.
Why?
The Nile.
So they're not dependent on any kind of rain. They have the Nile, the water, the runoff from the Ethiopian mountains comes running down through the entire land of Egypt and provides water through the entire Nile Delta, and they always have food. Okay? So he says, don't do that. Go to Gerar. Where is Gerar, modern-day Gerar? It's about 12 miles northeast of Beersheba. So it's a little, and in that area there's a natural spring, Nachal Gerar. Okay, it was an ancient Canaanite. They made a little park in Israel. We go on. 30 minutes to keep on rocking here. Okay, Casey, keep on going.
Isaac thus settled in Gerar. When the local men asked about his wife, he told them that she was his sister. He was afraid to say that she was his wife. Rebecca was so good looking, the local men could have killed him because of her. Once, after Isaac had been there for some time, Abimelech, king of the Philistines, was looking out the window and he saw Isaac enjoying himself with his wife Rebecca. Abimelech summoned Isaac. "But she is your wife," he said. "How could you have said that she is your sister?" I was afraid that I would die because of her, replied Isaac. What have you done to us? Demanded Abimelech. One of the people could easily have slept with your wife. You would have made us commit a terrible crime. Abimelech issued an order to all the people. Whoever touches this man or his wife shall die.
Okay, so question. What does the fact that Yitzhak had to lie about his relationship with his with Rivka, his wife, tell you about the people of Gerar? What?
Righteous people.
The righteous people?
No,
not at all.
They're dangerous people.
They're dangerous? What do you mean by they're dangerous? He had to go and act and says, oh, this is my wife. This is my sister. My sister Rivka.
Adultery is worse than murder.
Right. So what these people have, apparently they have a problem with adultery, because they're not going to. So they'll avoid the adultery problem. What will they do to solve the adultery problem? They'll make her single. How will they make her single?
Kill him.
She's now single. Husband's dead. Who had the same problem? Avram went down to Mitzrayim. They had to do the same thing. Apparently, in the ancient world, they had sort of like a taboo about sleeping with a married woman, but they had not much of a taboo on the murder thing. That's what the narrative tells us. So he had to act as if what? That she, they're brother and sister. So what happens? So what happened to their? What happened to the playing of husband, brother and sister? What happened to their ruse? They got caught. Obviously, they obviously thought that everything in the coast was clear. They felt that they were not under the subject of so much attention. And they were acting in a way, you know, there's a communication, there's interaction, which is brother and sister-like, and there's interaction which is husband and wife-like. And I'm not saying that he saw them having sex. It means that he could tell, but you could tell there's a way of a familiarity that was clearly not of the brother-sister kind. Okay, we keep on going. Dan Lastman, 26:12. Let's keep on rocking and rolling.
Isaac farmed in the area. That year he reaped 100 times as much as he had sowed, for God had blessed him. This was the beginning of his prosperity. He then continued to prosper until he became extremely wealthy. He had flocks of sheep, herds of cattle, and large retinue of slaves. The Philistines became jealous of him. They plugged up all of the wells that his father's servants had dug while Abraham was still alive, and they filled them with earth. Abimelech said to Isaac, go away from us. You have become much more powerful than we are. Isaac left the area and camped in the Gerar Valley, intending to settle there.
Okay, so we have Yitzchak in a famine year. He plants. What kind of happens when he plants? How well? He got 100% return, 100 times the return, in a bad year. Okay, so that's phenomenal. And therefore, he parlayed that agricultural wealth into what? Gold, silver, other flocks, sheep. He expanded his portfolio to a whole variety of assets. All right? Agriculture into cash and everything else. How did the Plishtim think about that? Were they happy for him? We're so happy for your success. No, were they happy? What did the king say? King Abimelech, what did he say? Get out! You become more powerful than us. Okay? Now, they did a weird thing. What did they do? They plugged up the wells that Avram's father had dug when he was still alive. Why did they do that? I mean, in other words, if you go to, when we're going to go to Israel together, the Middle East, to this very day, the most desired commodity is fresh water. So why would they cut off their nose to spite their faith by plugging up wells in their country during a famine? They're sabotaging themselves, and it seems to be clearly. It says the Plishtim became jealous of them. Then they did that. Why, in other words, if they had a desire to plug up Avram's wells, why didn't they do it a bunch of years earlier?
Because now they're jealous of Isaac, so they want to try and get him to leave by keeping his wife.
So you're saying this is a way. You're saying this is a way to undermine him by filling in his wells. Okay. It gets a little weirder. We're going to read a couple more sentences. Let me have Ariel.
No, I can't focus on my read out loud. I like me to hear.
Okay. Maror, Maror. You're going to randomly call people.
He redug the wells that had been dug in the days of his father Abraham, which had been plugged up by the Philistines after Abraham's death. He gave them the same names that his father had given them.
Okay, so, and the question number four is, why did you decide both to redig the wells as well as rename the wells with the names that Abram had named them? Now, this seems a very bizarre phenomenon. It is a famine. I understand you're jealous that the guy became very wealthy in a difficult time. So why are you, A, filling in the wells? Not only they fill it in, and then they plugged them up. In other words, they filled them in and then put cement on top. Like there was like a double process here. What did Yitzchak have to do with his staff do? Redig them and rename them. Which of course is, what do you mean they had names? Like Avram's place? Like, you know, what's going on over here?
Reasserting his claim to those wells.
But they're not Yitzchak's wells. They're identified with Avram, who's dead, his dad. Which reason, in other words, sometimes... Okay, let me help you, guiding you psychologically. Everybody has witnessed fighting at home, correct? And sometimes people are going to do a certain action, like, I'm not going to take out the garbage, but it doesn't mean about your unwillingness to take out the garbage. It really reflects other issues. So I want you to think about, why would they want... What issues are they trying to express via... They've already kicked them out by plugging up the guy's wells. And not just his wells, but not really his wells, but Avram's wells, which are named or associated with Avram. What's really happening? There's the... In other words, in fighting, it's always important to know there's the surface dynamic and there's the inner dynamic. The Talmud says that women are more adept at discerning that. It's called the Bina Yisera, the extra measure of insight. Men, like I go into a party and I'm with my wife and she says, don't you see what's going on? I say, what do you mean? Don't you see? No, I don't see, because I'm a guy. I am blessed with a sense of unawareness. So there's a certain, you can sense there's a tension, you know, like women are very good at picking up like there's a certain tension and people are ticked off and there's real going on and the guy's like, huh? You ever seen that?
Yeah.
Yes.
Never.
All the girls say, of course, Rabbi.
Well, didn't yes. That it wasn't about the wells. It
good.
Was about that Abraham was very successful in
yes.
spreading Judaism.
Yes.
And so he was successful in the wells. So seeing that if they would be rebuilt under Isaac, and he was successful in that, it would get more people to go along with Judaism.
Excellent. In other words, what's going on here is not about the wells. The wells is really about shutting down Avram's movement. Now, it's interesting thing is, why didn't they plug up the wells the day after Avram died?
They didn't understand that Yitzchak will get the merit and prosperity of Abraham.
So what were they thinking? What was their expectation to happen?
That it would end with Abraham.
It would. No, they thought that basically Abraham's Steve Jobs, and whoever is going to be the schmo that's going to take over is going to fumble the ball, and we'll just let it just wither away on the vine. And especially if you met Yitzchak, would you be impressed by this charismatic educator? Was he Avram-esque? No, he was not Avram-esque. He was his own guy, a little more reserved, a little more quiet. Okay? So they thought, we're not happy about Avram, you know, showing that our pagan, idolatrous lifestyle is foolish. We don't like that. And we're going to let it go die into the night. And then something happened. His son, in a famine, is able to parlay his unbelievable agricultural success into a vast empire to the extent that the king of the region feels so intimidated that he says, I simply can't tolerate your presence because you make me feel like what? Loser, loser, loser. You have to leave. I can't be the king if you're there because your mansion is casting a shadow on my palace. You got to get the heck out of here. He kicks him out. That's one dimension. The second dimension is, so they want to sort of have a covert war. What's their war against Avram? Shoving down his wells. What were his wells all about? There's many possibilities. But the basic idea, part of Avram's manner of communicating his ideas to the people of Canaan was through hospitality. Now, a person in a hot day comes to a spring. They're welcome to Avram's spring. And he says, didn't you know? It's Avram's place. Or he may have named it. You know, he may have named it with... It says later on there's a spring, the spring of the living Lord. You know what I mean? He would identify, he gave them certain names to reinforce his ideas, his philosophy, his way of life to the people. So whenever you went down to Avram's spring, it was the spring of Hashem. You know, whatever the name, we don't know what the name was. It was a way to reinforce, like at a marketing standpoint, his ideas. So if you want to shut down Avram's ideas, they had to do something very painful, which is to shut down those springs, because that caused everybody to flock over there and constantly reinforce his message. So they wanted to shut down Yitzchak. So what do? They fill in the wells. What does Yitzchak do? He redigs them and renames them. Why does he just walk back? Why is he standing up for this? Why is it so important for him to do this? He wants them to have fresh water?
He wants to protect his father's legacy.
He wants to maintain. In other words, his role is he's a maintainer. In a corporation, in a business, in a family, you have a person who has a role in the business of not necessarily expanding, but maintaining. And oftentimes maintaining a family business or enterprise is quite difficult. Yitzchak's role, he felt his role minimally is what? I got to keep the lights on. They're not shutting us down. So he redigs them. Then we get to the next part of the story. Okay, Ma'or B'Vakasha.
Isaac's servants then dug in the valley and found a new well brimming over with fresh water. The shepherds of Gerar disputed with Isaac's shepherds, claiming that the water was theirs. Isaac named the well Challenge, Isaac, because they had challenged him. They dug another well, and it was also disputed. Isaac named it Accusation, Sikna. He then moved away from there and dug another well. This time it was not disputed, so he named it Wide Spaces, the Chobot. Now God will grant us wide open spaces, he said. We can be fruitful in the land.
Okay, question number 5. Why did the shepherds contest the ownership of Yitzchak's first two wells?
They wanted water.
They didn't... They Yeah, but why specifically...
Yeah. New places, right? They weren't...
They dug... In other words, I mean, clearly seems a little bit insane. In other words, his people dig the well, and they're saying, what do you mean that's not your well? It's our well. I mean, this is like a whole fabricated fight here. Why are they fighting with a guy?
You do the work, we reap the rewards.
Okay, but is it about the water? What are they trying to really do here?
Stop him before he continues moving farther along the land.
Exactly. They want to shut him down. Yeah. He cannot have a success. The currency of success in the Middle East, water. It's not your well. And he names it, Asik means fighting. And then he names it again, Sidna, anger, accusation. But then there's something, then why do they, then they, but they stopped in the third well. What's up with that? Three's a charm? What's going on with the third well? What's happening here with the third well? Why?
He was persistent.
In other words, there's in every person who is having success, whether you're a musician, whether you're an actor or an actress, whether you're a business person, whatever you, when a person starts to rise, there'll always be people who are their colleagues who want to say, oh, they're not deserving of that success, it's not really their success, and try to rain on their parade and try to pull them down. But then there's a person, when there's a thing called, Malcolm Gladwell said so nicely, then there's a tipping point. When there's that point when a person has enough gravitas, enough power, where they have to accept that person as the movie star, as the rock star, as the titan of business. He has made it, and he's now established. Yitzhak was fighting. Battle number one. Battle number two. And they saw, we can't stop this guy. They basically gave up. And Yitzhak essentially, through the vehicle of the wells, ensured that Avram's legacy and message was maintained. Question.
Does this have a connection to when someone's converting, you're supposed to reject them?
You try to go through a process to ensure that they're truly sincere, and it's not a whim. It's not a whimsical exploration. So if they're persistent and it shows that they have true conviction of that they really want to become Jewish, then you accept them. But it's sort of a testing period to see if they really are committed to it.
I understand that. I mean the number.
Yeah, three in general in Judaism. Okay,
for forgiveness.
Correct. Three is in Judaism what they call the Hebrew word chazaka. It's called an illegal assumption. Three times mean that's a pattern that is significant. Okay? So correct. Okay, let's do the last part, and we might even end up early. Okay, Maor, B'Bakasha.
From there, Isaac went up to Be'er Sheva. God appeared to him that night and said, I am God of your father Abraham. Do not be afraid, for I am with you. I will bless you and grant you very many descendants because of my servant Abraham. Isaac built an altar there and called in God's name.
Stop right there. Why Hashem says, don't be afraid. What can you figure out? The Yitzchak is?
Afraid.
Of what? What is he afraid of?
Failing or potentially what's going to happen.
So from who? By whom?
People that are there. Those people that are living there.
Correct. Since he's now being assertive, aggressive, persistent, insistent, consistent to the people of Gerar, he's concerned that they might all gather together and say, we've had enough of this Jew boy, and we're going to lynch him. It has happened many times in Jewish history.
Yeah.
Why not? So Avraham, Hashem comes and says, Yitzchak, do not be afraid. We can assume that he had good reason to be afraid. Because to be a Jew, which is pushing forward this particular ideology, is generally dangerous. Okay, then there's interesting. The story takes a little twist. Keep on going. Yes, Matt.
He talks to God and he builds a well because he wants to establish in a city. He wants to establish a city, and so maybe in the past when he's building these wells, he doesn't want those people don't want those cities being established next to them.
That is very significant. Let me add upon that, Matt. Verse 25, the Moor just read, Isaac built an altar there and called out in God's name. What does that mean? He started going, God! God! What does it mean to call in God's name? There's a couple senses of that. What does that possibly mean? It can mean tefillah, prayer. He prayed to God. But that seems a little awkward because he just had a conversation with God. So it seems to be not that sense. What's another possibility? Declare, what does it mean? So he's just walking around like a raving maniac, like the guy on the subway? He's talking about Jesus coming, he's having a come to Jesus moment? The way that the Meforshim, the commentators, they talk about, he starts to educate people. He's calling out in God's name. He's educating people about Hashem. Or basically what he's doing, he's continuing the role, the responsibility, the mission of Avram.
He's acting out in the likeness of
Allah. Exactly. In other words, the shop, basically, the store is still open. Class is back in session. That's basically what he's saying. And he sets up a little well there, so as the man was pointing out, so people can come and gather. He's setting up shop. He's back in business. Let's go on. We get the last part of the story. Keep on rolling. Avimelech. Okay, so why did Avimelech want to make a covenant with Yitzchak?
Because he saw that God was on his side.
Okay, and so why do you want to make a covenant with him?
So that things will be good going forward. Right. He doesn't have a stronghold in this place.
The balance of power shifted from Avimelech to Yitzchak. So basically, now who's got to play ball with who? Avimelech got to come crawling on his knees with his entourage to Yitzchak's house. Oh, Yitzchak? Who is it? It's Avimelech. Don't you hit, you kick me in. In other words, he said, he calls him on. He says, you kick me out. You hate, he's, notice Yitzchak does not sugarcoat it. You hate me. You kick me out. Why the hell are you here? I happen to notice that Hashem is with you and I'd like to make an oath, which basically means I'm afraid of you, and I'm afraid that you're basically going to use your power, and you're going to gather some force. Because what? Now this is another psychological phenomenon called projection. What is the psychological principle of projection?
Anything that's going on in your head, and assuming that other people are thinking.
Exactly. So if Avimelech says, "I need to make a peace treaty with this guy," what is he imagining happening in Yitzchak's head? The what? So, but what is he thinking that Yitzchak's thinking? What? That he will attack. In other words, Avimelech says, if I was this wealthy and powerful, what would I be doing? I'd be basically kicking butt and leaving names. I'd take over the entire... I'd be a tyrant. In other words, he's a tyrant. What does a tyrant do when they have more power? Expand their territory. They never met a guy like Yitzchak. He wants to be left alone. He wants to teach people about Hashem. He's not looking through conquering countries. He's not trying to be Alexander the Great. Avimelech wants to be Alexander the Great. So therefore, if you can't beat them, you join them and you cut a deal. So so Yitzchak said, okay, I'm cutting you a deal. Fine. He was happy to do it. To conclude, I'm going to let you guys out 2 minutes early. Here we go. 8. The rabbi states, Ma'ase Avot, Siman Labanim. The events of the patriarchs is a sign to the children, foreshadowing Jewish history. What events did this story foreshadow in your mind? This event. But insofar as past history, we're not talking about future history.
It's the only thing I think about.
You are a tzaddik. Okay. Okay, good. Okay, so basically the story of Hanukkah is a good example. Basically, the Greeks wanted to basically snuff out Judaism. They wanted to, the Greeks and their Jewish, unfortunately, collaborators, wanted to Hellenize the entire Jewish people and shut down Judaism. And Judah the Maccabee, the Hashmonaim, revolted, and they were able to maintain Jewish sovereignty and Jewish practice and Jewish religion for another 200 years. What else does it remind you of? Okay, how so?
Well, I'm very excited, but Joseph became very successful as well, and God was with him materially in everything that he did, and therefore he acquired power because of it, even though he was this Jew-born slave.
Correct. In other words, the Yosef's success also is that he became very successful with Hashem's help, and there was Well, there was initially, and there was pushback, but Yitzchak was able to also, I'm sorry, Yosef was able to navigate that without getting, crushed also in the corporate halls of the Egyptian palace. What else? More?
I would say anti-Semitism in general.
Correct.
The Jews are constantly starting from nothing, becoming super powerful, getting to the top, and then they get squashed, and then repeat over and over and over.
Not anymore.
Okay, well, history ain't over yet. Let me just echo what Maor is saying. One of the amazing stories of the medieval times is a person named Don Isaac Abarbanel, who was one of the great commentators on the Chumash. In addition to being a great Torah scholar, he was also the minister of finance for Spain. Personal financier to Ferdinand and Queen Isabella. What did Ferdinand and Queen Isabella do?
Columbus.
Well, Columbus came from, but they did the Inquisition. So basically, they were in their Roman Catholic zealotry made the Jews of Spain the following offer: you can either convert to Catholicism or you can be burned to death. The big concession was, we'll let you leave, but without your money. Tragically, many Jews converted, and many Jews left. And with Don Isaac, they said, since he was their financial wizard behind the entire empire, said, you can stay with your cash. He says, I'm not leaving the Jewish people. He says, if you're going to leave, you're leaving your money with us. He left. He was the Jewish leader. He left with the Jews in 1492. On which day? Anybody know which day was the Inquisition? Tisha B'Av. Very tragic. So then they went to Portugal, which they had another couple years of good times. And then they also signed off on the Inquisition. And then you have this scene. Bibi Netanyahu's father was a great historian. He wrote a biography of Don Isaac Abarbanel. And he paints this very graphic picture of these Jews in the boats in the Mediterranean going from one dock and not being allowed to get off because they also didn't want the Jews. And they're starving. They wouldn't let them get food, anything. And they go to another place. And then there was like this one little duchy, one small little province in Italy that was in economically distress. So they knew one thing. You have economic problems, what do you got to do? You bring in the Jews. And what they do is the Jews would come in. They, of course, allowed to do usury, borrow, lend with interest. And then when they owed so much to the Jews, how do they cancel their debts? They kicked them out without their money. Don Isaac Abarbanel lost his fortune four times. So this event of Maase Avos Simin Labanim, of the anti-Semite trying to shut down Judaism, is not a story of Jewish history. It is the recurring story of Jewish history. Have a good night.
What about the
2 minutes early, guys.